of a rooming house. When Thompson investigated the Denver dwelling, he discovered that a man fitting Youngblood's description had actually lived there. And I should just mention real quickly, this Youngblood stuff gets real confusing. Remember Youngblood? Remember earlier we mentioned one of the people that was supposedly involved with a conversation about killing King, according to Byron Watson, by the name of Herman Jackson.
Also, remember that according to reporter Chastain of the Memphis Scimitar, this fellow, Jack Youngblood, was a former soldier of fortune who had been involved in the efforts against Fidel Castro of Cuba, and that he had strong intelligence connections, because this is going to figure prominently as we get on later in the broadcast. And of course, in our Guns of November broadcast, as in virtually any intelligent treatment of the Kennedy assassination, the involvement of anti-Castro Cubans and CIA soldiers of fortune and adventurers involved against Castro figure very prominently. Continuing with the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen. 4 hours after his lengthy conversation with Thompson, Youngblood introduced himself to two ministers under a different alias and proceeded to make a similar presentation and confession. Youngblood told the attorney and the clergyman that the King killer had impersonated a black man in setting up the assassination. A day before King arrived in Memphis, in fact, the manager of the black-owned and operated Lorraine Motel was visited by, quote, an advanced security man for Dr. King, unquote. When the advance man saw that King's suite was on the first floor, he told the manager, "No, no, Mrs. Bailey, that simply won't do. Dr. King always likes to stay on the second floor overlooking a swimming pool," unquote. When the advance man departed, the manager scoffed at an employee's suspicion that the security officer had been a white man imitating a black, unquote. King's accommodations were moved upstairs, where he was shot on the second floor balcony. The advance man remains a mystery to King's associates. No advance man had been assigned for his Memphis arrival, and no one in King's entourage fit the description. Interrupting briefly, recall that in our Guns of November broadcast, we played the very famous I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech, which Dr. King gave the evening before his assassination. And in that speech, he rather obviously and very poignantly foreshadows his own impending death. He talks about threats made against his life and says that he's not afraid and that he's lived a very full life. He also talks about the parable of the Good Samaritan and describes the place where that parable happened as being a marvelous place for ambush. So remember the seeming knowledge King had that he was in a great deal of danger, perhaps about to die, and this very curious, apparently non-existent advanced man who said that Dr. King always liked to stay on a second floor room overlooking the swimming pool, because the knowledge of this bogus advanced man may very well have been what prompted Dr. King to intimate his own impending death in that very moving speech. Continuing with Jeff Cohen's essay, in 1968, Ray told author Huey he had an uncomfortable feeling he was being tailed that fateful day in Memphis by a man he bumped into twice in separate taverns. "He looked at me kind of funny," Ray stated. The escapee hoped that the tale was Raoul's gun-smuggling contact and not a police agent. From a photograph shown to him by Wayne Chastain in May of 1974, Ray identified the suspicious man as Jack Youngblood. So what does it all mean? Three eyewitnesses can place Youngblood at the murder scene. Three more can testify to his reputed knowledge of a plot. Why did he visit Thompson and the clergyman? Law enforcement agencies apparently aren't interested in finding the answer. The FBI and Memphis police shunned the evidence offered by Chastain and Thompson. So remember Jack Youngblood and recall the involvement of a man named Herman Jackson in the syndicate, that arms, drugs, and gold bullion smuggling ring that operated out of, according to Robert Byron Watson, out of the Magellan Art Gallery in DeKalb County, Georgia. That's also Atlanta, of course, that same area. Now, reading a footnote here from the actual text of the Robert Byron Watson affidavit, and again, research credit to this goes to Mae Brussell, the first researcher to really grapple in a substantive way with the Watson affidavit. An interesting piece of information is provided here about Mr. Herman Jackson, the name used by one of the members of the syndicate that Robert Byron Watson overheard discussing the impending murder of Martin Luther King. The footnote says, "Mr. Herman Ballard, alias Mr. Herman Jackson, is also known as Mr. Walter Alfred Jack Youngblood." An interesting name to for this fellow to have used in light of the Raoul connection, in light of the Robert Byron Watson information, and the rather compelling information provided by a number of different eyewitnesses concerning the identity of the Eggs and Sausage Man.
Okay, one last thing on the subject. This is from the book Death in Washington by Donald Freed with Fred Landis.
Okay, that book published, by the way, in hardcover by Lawrence Hill and Company, copyrighted in 1980.
Okay, Death in Washington deals with the assassination of Orlando Letelier, a right-hand man to Salvador Allende, who was blown up on the streets of Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about one very small section here, and what they're talking about here is the CIA-sponsored, led, trained, and funded invasion and takeover of Guatemala. And it says, Guatemala, Freed writes, was the first Latin American country in modern times to challenge American hegemony. In free elections, it had voted into power the government of Jacobo Arbenz Guzman. Long before anybody had heard of Fidel Castro, revolutionaries like Che Guevara came to Guatemala to support the mildly anti-American regime of Colonel Arbenz. According to Barnes and Hunt, Arbenz was leaning too far to the left, and so had to be destroyed and replaced by a client of the CIA, General Carlos Castillo Armas. Castillo Armas had been liberated from a Guatemalan prison where he had been incarcerated as a traitor by a CIA contract team headed by two agents named Jack Youngblood and Frank Sturgis. So once again, we see Jack Youngblood's name crop up, this time in the company of Frank Sturgis, and even more importantly, in the context of the raid on Guatemala, the overthrow of Guatemala. One of the interesting things about that, of course, is not only was Guatemala supposed to be in many ways was it the training ground for the people who would eventually get involved with the Bay of Pigs, but also it seems that it was the training ground for a variety of people who would later on get involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and then later on Watergate. Sturgis, of course, was himself involved in the Watergate case along with E. Howard Hunt, also involved very heavily in the Guatemala overthrow. The man who trained the Air Force, or the air support for the Guatemalan overthrow, was a man named David Ferry, who later turned out to be a very close contact of Lee Harvey Oswald, among other people. And here we see Jack Youngblood, our putative Eggs and Sausage Man, also, according to Robert Byron Watson, one of the men who ran the art gallery that was a smuggling guns and drug center, and one of the men who helped to plan the murder of Martin Luther King.
Now, another interesting thing, recalling now our Guns of November broadcast, Frank Sturgis was not only involved with the Guatemalan operation, acting in conjunction with Jack Youngblood to spring Mr. Castillo Armas, slated by the CIA to replace Jacobo Arbenz, but also Frank Sturgis was involved, his name crops up, in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Recall now that in our Guns of November broadcast, we discussed a couple of letters, one of which was allegedly mailed by a Cuban intelligence agent named Pedro Charles, another of which, this too allegedly Lee Harvey Oswald to recruit him for an assassination job requiring expert marksmanship, another letter warning that Pedro Charles was the sort of the linchpin and the instigator of a Fidel Castro plot against the life of President Kennedy. Now, eventually, these two letters turned out to have been typed on the same typewriter, thereby seriously calling into question the bona fides of the Pedro Charles letter. Recall also that the source for that information was none other than Frank Sturgis. So the name Frank Sturgis, as with so many of the people involved in Watergate, crops up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, returning to, basically the point is that there are a number of different connecting threads, not only between the assassination of President Kennedy and the assassination of Dr. King, but with Watergate, and also with the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And some of those connections were documented on the Guns of November broadcast. And returning now to the Hudson Valley Chronicle, the Hudson Valley Chronicle article, which was authored by David Wemple, apparently this arms for drug smuggling ring was very much involved with the assassination of Robert Kennedy as well. Now, after Robert Byron Watson was seeking to escape the vengeance of... Well, first let me tell you, listen to KF. Captain Watson was attempting to escape the vengeance of this arms for drug smuggling ring and gold bullion smuggling ring, for having basically spilled the beans concerning his involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy, or of Martin Luther King, of their involvement, rather, in the assassination of Martin Luther King, he fled to, of all places, Chile. And as David Wimple puts it, that was going like going from the frying pan into the fire. At any rate, in Chile, he made the acquaintance of a couple of interesting people, notably a man named Dr. Anthony N. Malek, last name M-A-L-E-K. Malek was acquainted with, among others, a fellow named Fuad Habash Ansara, the brother of a man named George Habash, who was a key Palestinian exile leader and has been connected with, among others, the Black September Group, which, along with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, has been very heavily influenced and apparently to a certain extent manipulated by CIA. Returning now to the David Wimple article in the Hudson Valley Chronicle. As fate would have it, Watson's hurried journey to Chile would provide a vital piece to the puzzle of the King assassination. It was while in Santiago that Byron found it literally impossible to receive any funds which had been sent to him from home. When there was some more money to be had, he was befriended by the South American director of the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Fuad Habash Ansara, whose brother George Habash is the leader of the National Front. Habash and Watson, as it turned out, had a mutual acquaintance who often visited Magellan's in Atlanta. That man, Dr. Anthony N. Malek, was the party named by Watson as buying the gold bullion which was being smuggled into the United States by Herman Jackson. Recall that Herman Jackson is the alias which apparently Jack Youngblood used, or someone who used a number of different names, including Jack Youngblood. Habash and others apparently suspected Malek of being a double agent with the CIA, a possibility which surfaced when Malek traveled to Chile immediately prior to the CIA-inspired coup d'etat against Allende in 1973. If Habash's suspicions were correct, Malek was one of those CIA agents who had attempted to infiltrate such national liberation organizations as the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Central Intelligence Agency has, in fact, carried out infiltrative and provocative acts against such American groups as the American Indian Movement, Black Panthers, and Students for a Democratic Society. Later, in 1974, Watson claims that Herman Jackson told him that Malek was also, quote, the man who conceived most of the plan and worked out most of the details which were employed to assassinate Senator Robert Kennedy. And there were, according to researcher Mae Brussel, several links between Saran's family, the CIA, and Arab-connected clergy. To make matters worse, Dr. Malek is listed as a minister who was affiliated with the Greek Orthodox Church. It is in connection with this group that Brussel links CIA infiltration and manipulation of Saran's family. Recall that when Robert Kennedy was assassinated in June of 1968, that essentially removed him from, completely removed him from the presidential race of that year. He was almost certain to get the Democratic nomination and was a heavy favorite to defeat Richard Nixon that fall. Recall that in Guns of November, we talked about how Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963. When interviewed by the FBI in February of 1964, he maintained that he had left 2 days before President Kennedy's assassination. Nixon ran against Kennedy in 1960. John Kennedy, that is, was defeated by him. And as Niptuck observed in our Guns of November broadcast, one of the things that everyone seems to remember is where they were when President Kennedy was assassinated. Apparently, Richard Nixon's memory was off by a full 48 hours within only 3 months of the assassination. Recall also that, another piece of information presented in a book called The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by two authors named William Turner and John Christian, that the Saran family's entry into the United States was sponsored by a couple of close political associates and friends of Richard Nixon. Now, again, with all of our political assassinations, supposedly there are no connections between them, that there are no intelligence connections, just a bunch of lone nuts seeking glory or vengeance for one thing or another.
Well, we'll let you mull that one over while we take a short break, and we'll return to put some other things in perspective and add some more information and build the fire up a little bit and see what happens. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery, and we'll be back with the next hour of Radio Free America in just a matter of moments right here on KFJC, Los Altos Hill. Your chance to return from the kitchen or wherever, although I'm sure a lot of you out there just have your tape recorders on, because it's hard enough to sit and read and talk for 4 hours, and it must be just about as difficult, if not more so, to sit and listen for 4 hours, even to two gentlemen as delightful and erudite as myself and Mr. Emery. Anyway, let's just fade this nice cassette down in the background. The music you just heard, of course, was U2 with MLK, and before that, Iggy Pop with Play It Safe. What do we have in common? Play It Safe. Great song. Iggy Pop, those of you out there who are of the rock and roll persuasion may not be aware, old Iggy is a confirmed Republican, plays golf regularly. You never would have known it, right? The boy from Detroit. Okay, going back into the broadcast now, those of you who've been listening to the first hour and 5 minutes or so, I'm going to refer and confer and what's the word I'm actually looking for? I'm going to review, thank you, some of the things that we just talked about real quickly. Basically, okay, the thing that I want to make strongest and most obvious to those of you listening who are not familiar with this information, and some of you are familiar with a fairly good part of it that we've broadcast tonight, but once again is the basic fact that the state, which in this case would be the state of Tennessee, and the federal government, insofar as they have investigated the assassination of Martin Luther King, one of the major figures of our time, the state story is that James Earl Ray, a five-time felon, somebody who's been termed by many people a bungling criminal at best, managed to travel in and out of three countries for approximately a year and a half with no visible means of support, with no chain of robberies behind him to indicate where he might have gotten his money from, was able to find three aliases in Canada of men who seemed to be who are very much physically like James Earl Ray in terms of passport pictures and things like that. Managed to find well over $10,000 in money that he had picked up along the way. A man who had worked before and been in prison with black people and had said he himself had no prejudice. Somehow this man had conspired to pull off the murder of Martin Luther King, which he did in the following way. He managed to rent a room in a rooming house where nobody could identify him as being the roomer. In fact, several people identified the roomer as being much smaller and much younger than James Earl Ray. He managed to get up into the room of the rooming house and be there at the same time as he was seen across town getting air put in the tire of his car by a black gas station attendant. He somehow also managed to stand up on a bathtub, contort his body into a strange position, jam his rifle 6 inches into the wall, according to a ballistics expert, shoot Martin Luther King with one shot, in such a way that despite the fact that he was standing on a balcony, on a window that was above the balcony where Martin Luther King was shot, Martin Luther King's body was actually lifted up in the air, despite the shot coming from slightly above. Then James Earl Ray somehow managed to get his rifle back into the carton it had originally come in, run down the stairs, be seen by nobody except a drunk who identified him as being quote-unquote a nigger. James Earl Ray, of course, obviously is white. Run down the stairs, drop his gun, which linked him intimately to the assassination if he was the perpetrator, jump into his Mustang and speed away, and then manage to elude the police for 9 weeks, finally being arrested in England, and returned, and the man who was the only eyewitness to link James Earl Ray with the scene of the crime was an alcoholic with 155 arrests whose common-law wife, among other people, stated that he was completely drunk at the time of the assassination, who, as we have heard, we'll talk about the common-law wife some more in a moment, but who, as we have heard, himself identified the assassin first as a black man, then later the next day didn't even know somebody had been shot, and only later on, when it appeared that the state was going to be having trouble pinning this on James Earl Ray, came forward and claimed James Earl Ray was the man, had all his drink bills paid, was put up for some time at state expense, squired around to all the posh spots in town, etc., etc. This was the only man who linked James Earl Ray to the case. James Earl Ray then, as we shall see now in this upcoming section, had a succession of very bizarre attorneys who basically, we'll get into what his attorneys did in just a moment. But anyway, this is the state's case against Martin Luther King's supposed assassin, and as somebody who studied this kind of stuff for a few years, I must say it's even weaker than the case against Lee Harvey Oswald, if that can be considered as being possible, than this, in fact, is that case. It is a weaker case than the case against Lee Harvey Oswald.
Now, also, we've taken a look at an affidavit by a man named Robert Byron Watson, who maintains that the Magellan Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia, was being used as a front for a number of different kinds of smuggling, notably gold, drugs, and arms, and that the principals involved in this smuggling operation This syndicate he describes as being a combination of organized crime, intelligence, and defense industry heavies. He cites the late Congressman Larry McDonald as being financed and supported by this group, also a frequent visitor to this gallery. He maintains that they, in fact, were the principals involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King, that they also were connected to the assassinations of both John and, as we just saw, Robert Kennedy. Now, Robert Byron Watson was pursued, was blackmailed, eventually imprisoned as a result of his affidavit, and we saw also that one of the principal people involved in this organization was somebody named Jack Youngblood, and that a U.S. intelligence agent, associate of the anti-Castro crowd, and an operator against the Arbenz government in Guatemala was also named Jack Youngblood, and that Jack Youngblood appears to have been the eggs and sausages man identified by a number of different witnesses as having been the actual man who fired the shot that killed Dr. Martin Luther King. Recall that James Earl Ray identified Jack Youngblood as the fellow he saw tailing him the day King was killed, and remember, of course, that James Earl Ray maintains that his curious travels around the North American continent were affected by a fellow by the name of Raoul, a blonde-haired, red-haired French-Canadian who, according to James Earl Ray, was part of a smuggling operation. So this does certainly point at least in the direction of the Robert Byron Watson affidavit. Now, one of the key things in assessing the Martin Luther King assassination is to observe the curious handling of James Earl Ray. There is virtually no evidence of any substance against James Earl Ray. There is a lot of evidence, that massive amount of evidence, that he was innocent, and there is considerable evidence pointing to the guilt of Jack Youngblood. Now, one of the key elements in coming to understand who is behind the frame-up of James Earl Ray, and we're going to deal with a book called Frame-Up about the King assassination, is to take a look at how James Earl Ray's case was handled. Okay, now the lawyers who handled James Earl Ray's case are worth noting, and the curious handling of his situation is going to be described here in the essay that we've been covering, The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen.
Okay, number 18, most Americans, 63%, I'm sorry, this is from The Assassination of Martin Luther King, and I'm going to do this one and the next one just to get that cleared up. Okay. Most Americans, 63%, according to the Harris poll, were puzzled by or disapproved of the handling of Ray's trial. What occurred on March 10, 1969, wasn't a trial at all. To meet minimum legal requirements, five witnesses took the stand at the two-hour proceeding. The mini-trial was not without incident. During the reading of the stipulations of guilt, Ray stood up and objected to the, quote, no conspiracy clause attached to his plea. But before he could finish his statement, he was muzzled by the judge and his own attorney, Percy Foreman. More on Mr. Foreman later. Shortly after accepting the guilty plea, presiding Judge Battle said, quote, we have not heard the last of James Earl Ray. He is a pretty good jailhouse lawyer, and I expect he will be filing writs from now till doomsday, unquote. 5 days later, the judge fell dead in his office of a heart attack. On his desk sat a letter from Ray charging that Foreman coerced him into pleading guilty.
Now, recall that, one of the things that we're going to cover in somewhat greater depth is the fact that a book contract with William Bradford Huey was one of the main elements in getting James Earl Ray to plead guilty. Basically, his first attorney was a man named Arthur Haynes, last name H-A-N-E-S. We're going to cover Mr. Haynes' situation in some detail. And Haynes worked out a deal with the aforementioned author William Bradford Huey to have a book written about James Earl Ray. Now, Haynes had contracted for a percentage of the profits. Recall that, whether or not there would have been much market for a book about an innocent man, okay? That when a man's lawyer has signed for a percentage of the profits about a book, or from a book about this particular individual, it certainly has to be regarded as clouding the attorney's motives for his will to get his client off the hook. Okay, so that's a very important thing to remember about the people who are going to be handled, James Earl Ray's case. Now, the first author is a man named, first lawyer, really, is a man named Arthur Haynes, H-A-N-E-S. We're going to talk about him. There's a fellow named Percy Foreman, last name F-O-R-E-M-A-N. Also a southern racist named J.B. Stoner. We're going to talk about him. And, of course, later, when James Earl Ray effected his appeal, Mark Lane, the very well-known, quote, conspiracy theorist, unquote, and we'll talk about Mark Lane as well. Now, one of the interesting things about the assassination of Martin Luther King, and we've talked about some connecting links between that crime and the assassination of President Kennedy, is that there is an interesting transcript which links the assassination of Martin Luther King to the assassination of John Kennedy, and also links it to the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. That bombing, in which four young black girls were killed, was one of the focal points of the struggle for the for civil rights in the South during the 1960s, and eventually a couple of Klansmen were convicted in that crime. We're going to talk some more about that, but in order to approach the discussion of James Earl Ray's lawyers and their curious handling of his situation, it might be good to take away what we're going to do, really, is to take a look at a portion of this transcript. Now, this transcript was recorded in Miami. It was recorded by an undercover Miami police informant in an interview with a man named Joseph Adams Miltier, last name M-I-L-T-E-E-R. Now, Miltier was the Georgia representative for the National States Rights Party. The States Rights Party was headed by Jesse Stoner, J.B. Stoner, one of James Earl Ray's attorneys. Now, this transcript took place on November 10th. The interview, I should say, took place on November 10th of 1963, a full 2 weeks before President Kennedy was killed, almost. Yet, the information contained herein has never really been dealt with by the authorities. Part of a massive body of information that points to a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy that has been disregarded. Now, this particular transcript has come up in a number of different places. It, first of all, was published in a book called Frame Up. That is a book about the killing of Martin Luther King. That was authored by a researcher named Harold Weisberg, last name W-E-I-S-B-E-R-G, published in hardcover by Outerbridge and Dienstfree, D-I-E-N-S-T-F-R-E-Y, distributed by E.P. Dutton, copyrighted 1969 by Weisberg. If you can't find the book Frame Up, this same transcript is also contained in a book called The Assassinations, subtitled Dallas and Beyond. That's an anthology about an anthology of some of the key assassination literature, edited by Peter Dale Scott, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, Paul L. Hoke, last name H-O-C-H, and Russell Stettler, S-T-E-T-L-E-R. Copyrighted 1976 and softcover by the Vintage Press. And we're going to read you a portion of this transcript. Now remember, before dealing with the section we're actually going to read you here, that there is a lot of discussion before the part we're going to read you about the involvement of some of these far-right wingers in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Again, a key focal point in the struggle for civil rights in the 60s, and one of the most outrageous acts that was performed against those fighting on behalf of civil rights. And as we're going to see, there are connecting links between the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and the assassination of President Kennedy. Recall that this is a conversation between Joseph Adams Miltier, Georgia representative of the National States Rights Party, headed by James Earl Ray, one of James Earl Ray's lawyers, Jesse Stoner, and an undercover Miami police informant. This is on November 10th, 1963.
Informant: I don't know. I think Kennedy is coming here on the 18th or something like that to make some kind of speech. I don't know what it is, but I imagine it will be on TV, and you can be on the look for that. I think it is the 18th that he's supposed to be here. I don't know what it's supposed to be about. Subject: in this case, Miltier. You can bet your bottom dollar he's going to have a lot to say about the Cubans. There are so many of them here. Informant: yeah, well, he will have 1,000 bodyguards. Don't worry about that. Subject: the more bodyguards he has, the easier it is to get him. Informant: what? Subject: the more bodyguards he has, the more easier it is to get him. Informant: well, how in the hell do you figure would be the best way to get him? Subject: from an office building, with a high-powered rifle. How many people, and there's room noise and the tape is not legible for a moment, does he have going around who look just like him? Do you know about that? Informant: no, I never heard that he had anybody. Subject: he has got them. Informant: he has? Subject: he has about 15. Whenever he goes any place, they... not legible. He knows he is a marked man. Informant: you think he knows he is a marked man? Subject: sure he does. Informant: they are really going to try to kill him? Subject: oh yeah, it is in the working. Brown himself, Brown is just as likely to get him as anybody. He hadn't said so, but he tried to get Martin Luther King. Informant, he did. Subject, oh yes, he followed him for miles and miles and couldn't get close enough to him. Informant, you know exactly where it is in Atlanta, don't you? Subject, Martin Luther King, yeah. Informant, Bustis Street. That's a phonetic approximation. Subject, yeah, 530. Informant, oh, Brown tried to get him, huh? Subject, yeah. Informant, well, he will damn sure do it, I will tell you that. Well, that is why, look, you see, well, that is why we have to be so careful, you know, that Brown is operating strong. Subject, he ain't going for play, you know. Informant, that is right. Subject, he's going for broke.
Okay, before continuing with the transcript, recall that in the section Niptuck just read you, there is a description of a plan to kill President Kennedy by disassembling a high-powered rifle and bringing it up into an office building. More about that will be described here in the section I'm going to read you. That, of course, is the official version of what happened to President Kennedy. Now, whether or not shots actually were fired from the Texas School Book Depository, there's a fair amount of controversy about that. It has been definitely established by all who are willing to examine the facts of the situation that the fatal shots were not fired from the Texas School Book Depository, but rather from the grassy knoll and a number of other places in Dealey Plaza. But the official version of the Kennedy assassination maintains that a high-powered rifle was fired from an office building after having been allegedly disassembled by Lee Harvey Oswald. Continuing now with the transcript. Informant. I never asked Brown about his business or anything. You know, he just told us, you know. But after the conversation and the way he talked to us, there is no question in my mind who knocked off the church in Birmingham. You can believe that. That is the way I figured it. Subject, that is right. It is about the only way you can figure it. Informant, that is right. Subject, not being there, not knowing anything. Informant, but just from his conversation, as you and me know him, but if they did, it is their business, like you say. Subject, it is up to the individual. Informant, that is right. They are individual operators. We don't want that within the party. Hitting this Kennedy is going to be a hard proposition. I tell you, I believe you may have figured out a way to get him. You may have figured out the office building and all that. I don't know how them Secret Service agents cover all them office buildings or anywhere he is going. Do you know whether they do that or not? Subject, well, if they have any suspicion, they do that, of course. But without suspicion, chances are they wouldn't. You take there in Washington, of course it is the wrong time of the year, but you take pleasant weather, he comes out on the veranda, and somebody could be in a hotel room across the way there, and pick him off just like... The tape fades out at that point. Informant, is that right? Subject, sure. Disassemble a gun. You don't have to take a gun up there. You can take it up in pieces. All those guns come knocked down. You can take them apart. Interrupting again here before Niptuck finishes up this section of transcript, that the description of the plan to kill Kennedy that was just given also would fit the scenario for the Martin Luther King assassination, in which, I recall, Dr. King was out on a balcony talking to his chauffeur, and the fatal shot was then fired from either the hotel itself, the motel room, or from a clump of bushes just below that motel room window. So that we were seeing foreshadowing here of a number of crimes which did in fact occur, and of course linked to the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham.
Okay, informant. They have got a damn... This boy was telling me yesterday about they have got an explosive that you get out of the army. It is supposed to be like putty or something. You stick it up and use a small fuse. You just stick it like that, he told me. And I think this is what happened in the church in Birmingham. They stuck this stuff. Somebody stuck it under the steps with a short fuse and went on home. Informant. This boy is pretty smart. Demolition, is that what you call it? Subject. Demolition. That is right. Informant. I am going to talk with him some more. Subject. Yeah, I would. Informant. I am going to talk with him some more and find out a lot more about his operation because he knows a hell of a lot. Subject, you need a guy like that around, too, where we can put our finger on him when we want him. Informant, yeah, well, you have got somebody up there in that country now, if you need him. Subject, well, we are going to have to get nasty first. In a section that's illegible. Informant, yeah, get nasty. Subject, we have got to be ready. We have got to be sitting on go, too. Informant, yeah, that is right. Subject, there ain't any countdown to it. We have just got to be sitting on go. Countdown, they can move in on you. And on go, they can't. Countdown is all right for a slow, prepared operation. But in an emergency operation, you have got to be sitting on go. Informant, boy, if that Kennedy gets shot, We have got to know where we are at, because you know that will be a real shake if they do that. Subject: they wouldn't leave any stone unturned there, no way. They will pick up somebody within hours afterwards, if anything like that would happen, just to throw the public off. Informant: oh, somebody is going to have to go to jail if he gets killed.
Okay, recall the links between the description of the official version of the assassination of Kennedy, also an intimation that if Kennedy was killed, somebody would have to act as a patsy, and of course anybody who has examined the facts of the case realizes that Lee Harvey Oswald was in fact nothing but a patsy. He could not have killed President Kennedy. It's physically impossible. Also, the plan against the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, an interesting description of the actual killing of Dr. King, only presented in the scenario of a plot against Kennedy. And also, again, the links between these two crimes and the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Now, our first lawyer here, the first James Earl Ray lawyer we're going to be talking about, and recall that the subject there was Joseph Adams Miltier, Georgia representative of the States' Rights Party, and the head of that party was another Ray lawyer. But the first lawyer we're going to deal with is a fellow by the name of Arthur Haynes, H-A-N-E-S. And I'd like to recap a little bit of the information here concerning the book contract which Haynes signed with author William Bradford Huey. Again, from The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen. After being captured on June 8, 1968, Ray retained Alabama attorney Arthur Haynes, who strongly urged him to sell author William Bradford Huey the inside story as the only way to raise adequate defense funds. Haynes, Huey, and Ray signed three-way contracts. As the November 10th trial approached, a dispute arose over Ray's desire to testify in his own defense. Ray attributed his attorney's resistance to pressure from Huey, who wanted the exclusive story for his book. 2 days before the trial was to begin, Ray fired Haynes to get rid of Huey.
Okay. Dave is going to tell you in just a moment a little bit more about Arthur Haynes. Bear in mind here that we're going to be talking about a whole number of lawyers that are involved with the James Earl Ray case. He had several groups of several lawyers. However, again, the ones that we want to pay the most attention to are Arthur Haynes, who Dave is going to be telling you a little bit more about in just a moment. After him, Percy Forman. Percy Forman, of course, we talked about briefly earlier. He's going to be talked about in more depth. A man named J.B. Stoner, who for a long time was the head of the National States Rights Party, and we're going to be talking about him at some length because of his strange connections to the case, and as we mentioned earlier, his suspected connections to the Birmingham bombing just spoken about. And towards the end of the broadcast, one of James Earl Ray's last and perhaps not strangest, but definitely another one of his strange attorneys, Mark Lane, who we'll be talking about at some length.
Okay, now, reading a section here from a book called The Klan, an excellent book about the Ku Klux Klan, authored by a woman named Patsy Sims, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The book was published in softcover by Scarborough Books, copyrighted 1978. Now, of Arthur Haynes, the first of the James Earl Ray attorneys, she writes, "Arthur Haynes, former mayor of Birmingham, who has served as a defense attorney for several Klansmen. He and his son, Arthur Haynes Jr., represented Robert Chambliss in his 1977 trial for the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama." Now, Arthur Haynes was not only a former mayor of Birmingham, he was the mayor of Birmingham when the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing occurred. Okay, now, of course, we've seen in that transcript from an undercover Miami police informant and the head of the Georgia head of the National States Rights Party that the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing was connected to, or at least in a proposed way, to the proposed assassination of Martin Luther King as well as the assassination of President Kennedy. And Arthur Haynes was the mayor of Birmingham. He also crops up in many, many different contexts, including that of being a bitter opponent to the civil rights struggle. He was the mayor of Birmingham when Sheriff Bull Connor unleashed police dogs and fire hoses on civil rights demonstrators, and he's figured prominently in several of the key civil rights cases from that period.
Okay, skipping along a little bit on the subject of Arthur Haynes. Now, bear in mind that Arthur Haynes, as far as I know, was the very first attorney that James Earl Ray had after he got back from London. In other words, he got off the plane, was stuck into maximum security, and as we'd mentioned earlier in the story, if James Earl Ray's London attorney had seen the kind of background and circumstances of that, the lone eyewitness, Charles Q. Stevens, James Earl Ray probably never would have been extradited. Anyway, James Earl Ray was extradited, shipped back to the United States, stuck in maximum security, and the very first man brought in to see him was Arthur Haynes. Now, again, we're reading a little bit here, and we're going to start. June 16th, United Press International carried a story from Birmingham telling about and quoting Haynes. As of then, he had, quote, tentatively accepted this case. He was identified as, quote, mayor of Birmingham in the early 1960s when the city was the center of civil rights demonstrations led by Dr. King. He later defended two Ku Klux Klansmen charged with murdering Mrs. Viola Liuzzo, a white woman. I should just mention, too, that in the case of Viola Liuzzo, which has gone on and we've heard more of, actually now there have been allegations. It has been fairly definitely been proven that an FBI informant was in the car at the time, in the Ku Klux Klansman's car at the time that Viola Liuzzo was shot. And the two Klansmen involved, in fact, that Arthur Haynes defended, have charged that it was the FBI informant who shot Mrs. Viola or Viola Liuzzo. By the way, the section we're reading from is still from Frame Up by Harold Weisberg. Okay, going on. When Klansmen Collie Leroy Wilkins Jr. and Eugene Thomas were tried on state charges of murdering Mrs. Liuzzo, the Wilkins jury hung and Thomas was acquitted. Quote, this is still the UPI talking about Haynes. He later represented both men against federal charges that they conspired to violate Mrs. Liuzzo's civil rights. The two men were convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison, unquote. Further, quote, Haynes is a former agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He said he resigned from the FBI, quote, because I felt I couldn't express myself about the growing communist influence in our country as an agent, unquote. Cutting in parenthetically, at the time that Mr. Haynes had been a member of the FBI, which was probably predating his time as the mayor of Birmingham, would probably have been late 50s even, middle-late 50s, it's interesting to think that he felt constrained by the FBI, that notoriously pro-communist group, about making his anti-communist feelings known. With these credentials so uniquely identical with extremist belief, Weisberg writes, quote, Haynes said he had no idea whatsoever why Ray asked him to represent him, unquote. UPI might have had a few more words on Haynes' record. AP did, 2 days later, reporting that, when he was Birmingham's mayor, quote, international attention was focused on Public Safety Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor and the use of police dogs and fire hoses, unquote, against human beings. It says he defended the men in the Liuzzo case, the story refers to three of them, and, quote, when he was mayor, Haynes accused King, that's Martin Luther King, of being one of the instigators of Birmingham's troubles. Haynes, age 51, comes from an old Alabama family. His grandfather was a Confederate officer. Father was a Methodist minister.
Now, interestingly enough, not only was Arthur Haynes the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, when the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing occurred, recall the links to the Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations, not only did he defend the killers of Viola Liuzzo, recall the involvement of an undercover FBI informant named Gary Thomas Rowe in that crime, according to the Klansmen who were convicted, he actually fired the shot. He was a bitter opponent of Dr. Martin Luther King. He felt that the civil rights struggle was in essence a communist plot. Plot, okay. Now we're going to examine that last piece of information right here. Again, this piece of information, just like the last one Nip Tuck read you, coming from the book Frame Up by Harold Weisberg, from which our transcript of the Miltiard interview was taken. Again, Weisberg writes, Time magazine for June 28th added this little note. In 1963, though just out of office as a bitterly anti-integration mayor, he continued to fight against Martin Luther King's Birmingham campaign. Soon, the AP had dug up his statement that the black efforts to get better treatment than having police dogs and high-pressure water hoses turned on them, quote, were not spontaneous, but had been carefully plotted at a communist-inspired workshop, unquote. The docile blacks, content at being battered and bitten in the Haynes view of life and people, would never, left to themselves, have a word to say. Nothing pleases more than such abuse for which Haynes was responsible. To protest, they have to be inspired, unquote. This protest has to be plotted, unquote. It could not be natural or spontaneous, unquote. And where plotted? In a workshop that was communist-inspired, unquote. The phrase used to escape retribution for false use of the libelous slur, communist. It is a standard propaganda term of the most extreme, the most fascist-minded. It is used to say that persons or persons they do not like are communist when they dare not use this word, because if they do, they can be sued. Now, recall on the subject of communism that Arthur Haynes was a former FBI agent who resigned from the FBI because he felt that in this capacity, he would not be able to properly express his anti-communist sentiments. Now, recall that in the FBI of the early 1960s, very few people would suggest that one was constrained from expressing anti-communist sentiments. So this will give you an idea of just how extreme Arthur Haynes was in his anti-communist sentiments.